The championship series are a rolling on this episode of Baseball Barbacast. We will review game one between the Yankees and the Guardians, as well as game two between the Dodgers and the Mets, and look ahead for what's next. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world dressing up as Mark Vientos for Halloween. I'm Jake Mintz, that's Jordan Schusterman, and there is nothing scarier than a locked-in slugger with opposite field power. Woo!
Who has more Halloween representation in a couple of weeks? Mark Vientos or Luke Weaver? Both of which would be incredible questions at the beginning of this season. I think I would have believed Mark Vientos a lot more, even if you asked me back in March, as the Luke Weaver Renaissance continues to blow my mind. But we are going to begin with the National League Championship Series on this Tuesday edition of Baseball Barbacast. This will be a little bit of a quicker episode, but we had two games, two fairly straightforward games, which makes our jobs easier. But we also like to talk about baseball. So we're back, and we are going to begin in the National League, even though you were in the park for the American League Championship Series Game 1. But let's start with that first game yesterday, Jake Mintz. The Dodgers and the Mets. After the Dodgers absolutely demolished the Mets in Game 1 with a third consecutive shutout for their pitching staff, tying a Major League record for 33 consecutive scoreless innings in the postseason, what did Francisco Lindor think about that?
Cute streak.
that's nice. I'm Francisco Lindor, and all I do is do cool things on a baseball field. He gave us the incredible sequence of fouling a ball off his foot and smiling and laughing and wincing, and then immediately homering on the next pitch as the Dodgers bullpen game, opened by Ryan Brazier, was immediately off to a not so great start as the Mets take that early lead and then really blow it open in the top of the second.
Just one bottom of the first moment. We see our first Sean Manaea versus Shohei Ohtani matchup. And it becomes obvious rather immediately that Ohtani is going to have a tough day against Mr. Manaea, a left-handed sidewinder.
This is a little anecdotal, but as amazing as Ohtani is, when he isn't seeing it well, he can look very, very silly. And normally what happens is he processes the information, and the next time he faces that guy, whether it's the next at bat or later or a couple days later, which again, we very well may see when I against Ohtani again later this series, I have a feeling it will look as goofy, but he can look pretty perplexed. And in both of these first two at-bats, the first one, he was about as late as you'll ever see a major leaguer on a fastball. I mean, he was just completely fooled. And then later on in the game, he just watched two fastballs right down the middle. So yeah, the Manaea arm angle, as we've seen, flummox many an opponent over the last few months. It was Ohtani joined the club here.
Yeah, with all due respect to, that's not what that phrase means. You know, it's understandable. Because the ball is coming from first base, right? Like, it is not a particularly easy angle for Shohei to see. All right, but this game really breaks out in the top of the second. The Dodgers go to Landon Knack as their bulk boy. That does not turn out well. The Mets score a run on a Tyrone Taylor RBI double. They intentionally walk Francisco Lindor to load the bases with the base open, bringing up Mark Vientos, who goes yard, ripping an opposite field grand slam on a down the pipe 3-2 fastball.
It was the ninth pitch of the at-bat. It was two outs, right? So the choice to walk Lindor with two outs. Vientos, of course, after the game, talking about, I took that personal, as he should. That's totally reasonable. But what you just saw here with Landon Knack, and Dave Roberts was very honest before the game, saying, like, yeah, this is probably who's going to pitch in bulk. We're probably not going to go one inning at a time. And Landon Knack, one of their prospects who we have seen pitch in longer roles, but he, as well as some of the other Dodgers pitchers, I know our dear friend Craig Goldstein was tweeting about this, and I was talking to him about this. He's a Dodger fan. He just didn't really have that out pitch. And while he just kept going slider, 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 trying to get Vientos to chase, eventually he was like, I don't want to walk you with the bases loaded. I don't want to walk in a run. so let's see if you could hit my 90-95, and Mark Vientos can hit that. And he torched it. I mean, this was just a beautiful opposite field swing. Yes, the ball was right down the middle, but after a long at bat like that, this wasn't just like a first pitch ambush. I mean, he worked for that pitch and he got it, and he made him pay.
All year, really, we've been talking about how we're concerned with the lack of Dodgers starting pitching because of all these injuries. This was the game where it came back to really bite them. And it's tough for me to like blame Landon Knack, a rookie who was not on the opening day roster, a player who, if the Dodgers season had gone to plan, probably wouldn't even be on a playoff roster. And for him to have this responsibility in this spot is just a product of the number of people on the injured list. At the same time, he looked completely overwhelmed, out of sorts. Everything was getting either too much plate or none at all. And the Mets took advantage. The Dodgers turned the ball over to Brent Honeywell. And just a very quick aside, Brent Honeywell Jr., if you're not familiar, top prospect coming up with the Rays, wins MVP at the Futures game in 2017, blows out in 2018 during spring training. A barrage, an avalanche of arm injury sets his career back. Doesn't make it up to the big leagues until 2021. Moved to the bullpen, up and down with various teams. Had some success last year as a Padre. Those of you who've been listening to us for a long time know that Brent is one of our favorites. One of the players in baseball we just care the most about and think the most about and have the deepest connection to. And to know what that dude has battled through, to see him throw three scoreless innings on a playoff mound was so cool. Like, so freaking cool.
And I know the Dodgers don't ultimately end up coming back, but he does keep them in a game in a way that he makes the game more interesting, right? I mean, there's a world where the Mets end up scoring 15 runs in this game, and that's not what happened. But yeah, I mean, obviously, I'll echo everything you said about Brent. I've said this before about him, and we had him on our show last year when he was with San Diego. But, you know, many times you turn on a broadcast and you hear a broadcaster like Joe Davis talk about something that a player's been through. And it's not a throwaway line, like it's a reason to do that. And it always happens with Brandon. Of course, the first time he's making his playoff debut, he's mentioning, you know, forearm surgeries, a lot of time away, all these things. But to really understand what that means, having talked to him through all that is really something. And it's been really cool to see him be a part of this team. I mean, I said this fun fact to you, Jake. He was fourth on the Dodgers in innings after they claimed him from the Pirates on waivers, right? Like, he was very important for them over the last few months. When all those injuries were happening, someone had to throw those innings, and he was doing it for them. And ultimately, he had an injury at the end of the season, which is part of why he was not on the original CS roster.
Yeah.
But he steps in here and really gives them what they need. So we'll see if that, you know, pays dividends later. But ultimately, look, we know the Dodgers, the reason they lose this game is you know, Brent did his best to keep him in it. It wasn't even necessarily that Knack got blown up. It's that the Dodgers offense, which we thought was not going to really have a game like this, because of Manaea and because of some, you know, delicate work from the three really main Mets relievers, the Dodgers offense just couldn't quite get anything going, at least at the right times. And their top of the lineup goes, 0-for-19. They're 1-through-5, 0-for-19, I think, which is pretty shocking.
That ain't going to do it. No. They do get a solo shot in the fifth inning for Max Muncy. Manaea runs into trouble in the sixth. The Dodgers score two runs on a Tommy Edmonds single up the middle. Kike
three hits for ending Tommy. Ending. Tommy three had three of the Tommy. Dodgers' five hits. How about that?
Love that. Tommy Bahama. They bring in Maton. Maton kind of just skirts out of the inning somehow. Dodgers score those two runs on a ball that Pete probably should have had, which was kind of a tough look. Seventh inning, Stanek comes in, gasses up Mookie. Just quickly on Ryan Stanek, it's the ideal reliever, really. Like, big paunch, long hair, throws gas for like 22 pitches, sits down, screams, sits down. Awesome.
Yeah, no, he checks a lot of boxes for what you want to see there. I know he's had some frustrating moments, and maybe pure talent wise,
that's what I'm saying, though.
But yeah,
that's the best reliever, right? Like,
that's true.
If I'm rooting for a team, I obviously want zero runs ever allowed. But as a neutral observer, Ryan Stanek checks every single box. The Dodgers allow another run in the seventh inning to make the score 7-3. Eddie D does come in the eighth to kind of close that inning out for a four-out save. Two base runners in the ninth, but then he strikes out Mookie, Teoscar, and Freddie to end the ballgame. Mets win this one 7-3. Three main takeaways, Jordan Schusterman. What's your first one?
Yeah, I mean, the first one is what I just mentioned before. It's 0-19 from the top five is pretty. And by the way, Minaya, certainly over those first few innings, was very good. But I would say he was not, especially command-wise, not nearly as sharp as what we saw against the Phillies. And I think that's reflected in the fact that the Dodgers did draw eight walks, right? I mean, there was traffic, but they couldn't get the big hit. They had a couple of very untimely double plays, and or I guess just the one, the Kike one in the sixth. But yeah, I mean, that's just you just don't see the 0-19 from those five hitters very often. But that's possible in any individual game, and that's why that's really why they lost.
And then the second main takeaway for me is the Dodgers just have a starting pitching disadvantage. We previewed this when we talked about the series, but they're gonna probably have to do this again. They're gonna have to do the bullpen day again. Now they can go about it in a slightly different way, but if this series goes six games, which it kind of smells like it's going to, at least six games, they're gonna have to throw someone they don't really want to throw.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, I fall somewhere in between just because we saw it work flawlessly against the Padres. So the true talent of the bullpen game, even though it's so volatile because of how many guys you're relying on, is probably better than what we saw because of the personnel that they ended up deploying, right? We didn't actually see any of the Dodgers' quote-unquote best relievers. I guess Brazier would be in that mix, but we didn't see Phillips, we didn't see Trinan, we didn't see Kopech, right? We didn't see Hudson. And so that seemed to be mostly intentional, and that's why it was valuable for you know, our friend Brent to keep them in the game. But yeah, so I what you're saying is totally fair, but I also think that like the best version of the Dodgers bullpen game is a lot better than this because we know they have better relievers.
But it's not better than Sean Manaea, which is what they will be going up against if they bullpen game again. My last takeaway, here's a leading question. Bases loaded in a big spot in these playoffs. How many dudes would you rather have up than Mark freaking Vientos?
I mean, is Landon Knack pitching still? Because then I'll take Vientos for sure. I mean, I don't know. I know the reason you're asking is that Vientos had a huge CS or a huge DS, right? He has already had multiple huge moments in this postseason, and he has looked locked in. You know, he's also 4-3 strikeouts in the first game. I don't know. He's very good. We've talked about him. The fact that he has elevated his game to be obviously the Mets, like to be the Mets' number two hitter, not second best hitter, although arguably he is that too. Right now is incredible. Huge credit to him. I still think that there's pitches you can make to get him out, but you could say that about most of these guys. So I'd rather have Juan Soto up with the bases loaded if that's what you're asking me. Yes.
Yes, I also would too. If you're going off of top OPS so far this postseason, which obviously small sample size, like Mike Harris is first because he played in two games. Obviously that doesn't count, but it's really like Tatis,
remember
Bryce,
him.
Remember Fernando, Tatis, Bryce, Stanton, frickin' Brian Rocchio, who we'll get to, all right, and then Vientos, and then of course the home run Stroka.
Oh, I miss him too. Sorry, Padres. Anyway, but hey, I guess that this isn't really a takeaway, but it's just a reminder that as strongly as we feel after these game ones, especially in a best of seven, let's just take a breath and see how game two goes, because obviously the Mets are feeling quite good despite being embarrassed in that game one as they will head back to Citi Field, where you will be for game three. Quickly on that before we take a break, it will be Walker Buehler and it will be Luis Severino. And we've said this a few times about Walker Buehler over the last few months and certainly over the course of the season, but as the stakes continue to get raised, I mean, now or never, buddy. Like, we keep waiting to see if there is a version of Walker Buehler that's in there. Any hopes that he was going to come back and look like old Walker Buehler and sign for $200 million. I mean, that's all far out the window at this point, but there are still opportunities ahead for him to you know, give them five strong innings. And it hasn't happened very often this season, but this is certainly an opportunity here.
Just a quick word on Severino, who flew back to New York ahead of the team. And it was reported that he was wearing eye black, as the Mets have started to do during games, with the numbers, I believe, 59 written in eye black on his face for Sean Manaea, that day's starter. Now, my question is this. First of all, great, hilarious, goofy. The Mets are theater kids. I have no notes on that. How long until he wiped it off? Because you would imagine that Severino is flying first class on a cross-country flight. Obviously, he's not taking his own plane. The Mets are sending him back solo. Is he just like squeezing into probably Delta, because it's the Mets, a Delta first class seat with just the 59 eye black and like a jumps, like a sweatsuit? Is he doing that the whole, is he wiping it off on the plane? Is he wiping it off in the airport? It's a good bit, but when does it end in my mind?
I think he seems pretty committed. I mean, in theory, no one would test him on it, you know, once he leaves the team, right? Once he leaves the team hotel wearing the eye black. And I don't know if you know, this was a kind of a payback in a positive way too. Manaea did the same thing during Severino's start. Yeah. Manaea was wearing the eye black with the 4-0, but that's different than wearing it on a public flight to the airport. All those things is very nice. But Severino seems like an awesome teammate. Well, I mean, it's not like, it's not, I mean, the eye black itself is what's more quote unquote uncomfortable than the number. So if it's on and he's comfortable with it, then sure.
Can you imagine just getting on a flight and Luis Severino, you just walk by him in first class and he's got eye black on? Or like you're at Hudson News, just give him a buying fist bump, a candy bar.
Like, hey, Manaea Day. That's right.
OMG.
OMG. OMG, that's my guy. So anyway, that's OMG. Game three.
Luis Severino's on my flight.
Right.
Which reminds us, obviously, of the time we were on a flight that was delayed for 3.5 hours and Michael Conforto was sitting in first class.
That's true. He was not wearing eye black to my recollection. All right. That is the NLCS. We will take a quick break. And when we return, we flip it over to the American League, where Jake was witness to game one between the Guardians and the Yankees. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. If we had any Taylor Swift references, we would use them now. Tay-Tay, the most famous woman on the planet, was in attendance last night in the same building as yours truly to catch some Guardians baseball. Yes, Travis Kelce, Taylor Swift's boyfriend, is a Cleveland sports boy, and he was at the game on the Chiefs bye week. We'll talk a little bit more about those two later and banter quite a bit about their presence. But let's dive into ALCS game one between Cleveland and New York. Cleveland throwing Alex Cobb out there against Carlos Rodon. The backdrop, obviously, Rodon was but in his ALDS game two start, electric for three innings. The wheels fell off in the fourth, and he was out of the ball game in the blink of an eye. The Yankees entered this series with a distinct advantage on paper and, of course, on payroll, but they actually have to play the game on the field. And I would say we learned something pretty quickly about how Carlos was going to approach this game. There were a lot of questions in between his starts about his demeanor, about controlling his emotions, and which is both understandable and a little funny, right? He gets a strikeout to finish the first, and he acts as if he was just playing catch with his kid in the backyard after doing so, which is notable because in game two of the ALDS, when he struck out the side of the first inning, it was as if he'd won the lottery. It was kind of how he was reacting. And so we had a glimpse early that Carlos was going to approach this outing from a slightly different tilt. First run in this game is a Juan Soto bomb in the bottom of the third. Quick aside here. The experience of a playoff home run when you're in the bathroom. Have you had this?
Yeah, absolutely. Not this so far this year, but I can think of a couple examples. Yeah.
obviously you'd rather watch the Juan Soto home run.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is a kind of a tough look for you in terms of timing the bathroom. We don't go have to go into details, but like if Juan Soto's coming up and Aaron Judge, like that's not a great look for you, but continue.
I saw Judge hit. Okay. So I caught
half
the show.
You got back in time for Judge is your point.
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
Okay, but fine.
The experience of sitting there and just hearing that and knowing that you totally screwed the pooch is so unique and hilarious. Okay, so Soto opens the scoring. Alex Cobb comes apart, walks the bases loaded. Guardians bring in Joey Cantillo. Cantillo.
Yeah.
Cantillo. And this is like the first big moment of the game. Look, could we talk for 2 hours about going to Joey Cantillo instead of Eric Saprowski? Yeah. Should we? No. Cantillo can't throw a strike. Two wild pitches in that inning. The Yankees score two more runs. Cantillo walks a couple more guys. Two more wild pitches in the next inning. Four wild pitches, the most in a playoff game since Rick Ankiel had the yips.
Not a record you would like to tie under really any circumstance.
No, ESPN is not cutting into your previously scheduled programming to show you Joey Cantillo going for the wild pitch playoff record. No.
He might have, by the way, I should just say, he might have set that record if they left him in to face Judge.
Because he got one out.
Right.
And it was in this moment, right? I'm thinking, that's hilarious. Taylor Swift is here.
Oh, yeah. I had a few of those moments during that game. Yeah, I mean, like, we can jump ahead of the takeaways. Like, we didn't... Was that really... Can we go all in on saying what was vote thinking? Oh, he emptied his bench and ended the game with Austin Hedges? Sure. But all of this... And I said this during the Detroit series multiple times, so I'll just get this big picture point out of the way now, because there was this similar discourse, if not to the same extreme degree, against Detroit and how some of the choices. It's just like, listen, what you're reacting to is the personnel, not more necessarily than the deployment, particularly on offense. And so, which is, that's fine. That can be a critique of the roster. That can be a critique of just how we get here, whatever. But that's really what it is. And I said in the moment, yeah, sure, probably if you want to keep this game close, you do Sabrowski instead of Cantillo. But that's not what changed this game. And you could say it because the Guardians did keep it close. This, when after that inning, we're like, Yankees are going to win 25-0. And that is not what happened, right? The Guardians clearly stayed in this and had the tying run, you know, coming up a couple times later on. But I did not come away from this being like, managerial disaster. That's why Cleveland had no chance. Like, that's not what happened here.
You know, it doesn't really pinch it at all. The Yankees, because they usually have nine guys they like enough to keep the lineup, right? Like, yeah. The Guardians are obviously playing a slightly different ballgame here, and that's the reality of it. Yeah. But it's just a reminder that a manager is only as good as the personnel they're able to use. In this one, after the Cantillo walk fest, it's 4-0. Then it becomes 4-1. Brian Rocchio, who has been incredible this October, pops Carlos for a solo home run. And Rodon gives up bombs, right? Like, he was tied for second in baseball this year in home runs allowed. That's just because he throws a lot of fastballs at the top of the strike zone. And if you beat him to that spot and you put the right swing on it, you can get him. Perfect example. Really good pitch. Like, this was a fastball in on the hands on the inner black, and Rocchio just beat him to the spot and hit it out to left, right? Now, if you're Rodon and you're up in the game, you're going to attack with the fastball so you can work as deep as possible. So it made total sense that he gave up a homer. But the key was Rodon did not walk anybody last night. And so there was no one on base when he allowed the inevitable home run, allowed only three hits on the evening, finished the game after six innings with that Rocchio solo shot is the only blemish, and it's 4-1 Yankees when Rodon leaves the game. We'll talk about him a little bit more in a second. Just want to speed through the rest of this game. Giancarlo Stanton disappears of baseball in the seventh inning. Jordan, the wind was really blowing in. This is something I haven't mentioned yet. First cold day of the year last night. Like, I wore a scarf, not just because I was chilly, but because I'm a stylish young gentleman. We had people in parkas. Tonight's going to be even nippier. I'm going to go under my bed here next to me and pull out my big winter coat, the one that makes me look like Big Shaq. You know what I'm talking about?
Wow.
Scoop-a-pop-pop.
I'm going to be listening to Big Shaq a lot. I'm just going to alternate between Big Shaq and GMAC Cash today, I think is my plan.
Incredible. 1 + 1 = 2 - 1. That's 3. Quick math. Stanton just rips one through the wind. Like, obliterates a ball. He is awesome when he is locked in like this. If you look at his chase rate so far in October, granted small sample size, much lower than it is during the regular season. What that means is he's forcing pitchers into the strike zone earlier in counts than he usually does. He's getting up in counts and he's getting pitches to hit. After the game yesterday, he talked about how, look, in the playoffs, you're just more locked in on everything, right? You don't know, you can't like copy and paste that vibe to mid-June. It just kind of happens. Nick Castellanos talked about this with defense, remember? Mm. And so Stanton being this version of himself in the biggest moments is so, so cool. It's so good. And a reminder that, like, he might be a Hall of Famer. Like, this
is going to have 500 home runs. I have many a Stanton thoughts and, you know, fourth highest slugging percentage in postseason history, all these things. Two quick things on Stanton and the home runs, because I was going to mention it earlier with Soto, because that was, while it was technically a wall scraper, that was a ridiculously impressive home run considering the circumstances. And I know he's owned Cobb, but that was a classic Juan Soto just hitting the ball exactly as you need to for it to go over the fence with just an absolutely beautiful swing. Whereas Stanton, just the brute force of it was so overwhelming. And I have to mention this because you would not have noticed this, but one of the unintentionally funniest moments of the broadcast was, so at this point in the game, Eric Sobrowski is in, and Eric Sobrowski, a rookie left-hander, incredible story. I'm not going to recap the whole thing, but his development is amazing, and he has been outstanding for Cleveland over the last month and has not allowed a run. He had not allowed a run in the big leagues yet. He had not allowed a home run since like the middle of June in the minors. And Lauren Jabara, the dugout reporter for the broadcast, is talking about how this is the first time Eric Sobrowski, who's from Edmonton, I believe, has ever been to New York. And so she's talking about how, like, oh, I talked to Eric earlier and he's having a great time. Like, or like, this is his first time in New York. Can you imagine? Wow, pitching in the ALCS. And he had just struck out Austin Wells. And so that's when they sent it to her. And it's like, wow, you know, Eric's, he's just so happy to be in New York. Boom! Just like Lauren is like still talking and just unloads. And it was like, I mean, not exactly the matchup that we were looking for. I mean, he's still in the game there, you know, to get Wells and to get Jazz, which he did. He struck out Wells. He struck out Jazz. But Giancarlo just obliterated one. I encourage going back and watching it because it is unintentionally very funny. But Eric Sobrowski, awesome story, awesome dude, and definitely a useful. He will be getting important outs for this team. He already showed it in this game. It's just probably don't want him facing Stanton again, I would say.
Now, the Yankees just keep walking. I mean, walks are good. They're on pace to shatter the all-time walks record in a postseason if they keep this up. But they don't really get the big hit in this game to break it open. And so the Gardos kind of hang around. They score another run in the eighth against Tim Hill for the first Yankees earned run allowed by a reliever this postseason. There was a very bizarre obstruction play in which, let's be clear, Tim Hill was very much at fault. She was like standing easily in the base path.
Totally.
Like, and, you know, the Yankee crowd boos after they react and they chant. And like, it's like, yes, like, good, that's right. But it was just not just so clear cut. And Boone said as much after the game. Like, you, if you're the pitcher, you cannot just stand in the baseline. Like, it's just not allowed. So they, Stephen Kwan, RBI single. Luke Weaver comes in though, and he shuts the door. He's a little wild in the ninth again. The more you lean on a reliever, the more you try and suck more outs out of a guy who's not used to it, riskier it gets. I know Weaver was a starter, but it's obviously a different thing. But
a bad starter. I mean, again, it's not even that. It's not even about the length. It's more of just like having him do these same five out outings over and over and over. And he's just been so good for them. And, you know, he can, because of how the lineup shakes out, the last two outs are Daniel Schneeman in his first postseason game and Austin Hedges, who's one of the worst hitters in baseball history. So it worked out for him, but, you know, and Luke Weaver has been unbelievable. And I tweeted this. We've seen so many bad starters turn into good relievers, but boy, was Luke Weaver bad. I mean, he was a literal punchline in Cincinnati, a lovable punchline. Everybody loved him there. Everyone loved talking. And as we are now learning that he is being introduced to a national audience from both a personality and player standpoint, people love Luke Weaver. But this guy was, this was not just, oh, a couple years of it. No, he was 8 years as a starter with like a 5.5 ERA. And now he is just, wow, he is nasty.
So the Yankees hold on and win this one by the score of 5-2. They're up one game in the ALCS. Three takeaways. Number one, Carlos. Carlos put on his big boy pants and he delivered. Look, this is why this team paid this guy, because he can conjure performances like this. His 25 swings and misses, the most ever by a Yankees pitcher at home in a playoff game. Not just like this Yankee Stadium, but like all of the Yankee stadiums, right? Now, granted, no one before 1960 was, you know, getting more than two whiffs at a start.
I was going to say, yeah. And I don't know if we have exact pitch tracking data all the way back, but it has to be up there. As we know, even in the pitch tracking era, it's, I think, a top five swing and miss game of any starter over the last, 15, right, 20 years. So,
and a lot of it was just because his fastball command was a lot better.
Yeah.
He was getting in and getting up, especially against right-handed hitters. And a lot of that is because he was just more under control, right? Here's what was so interesting about Rodon from last start to this start, right? And I wrote a little bit about this. He didn't change much about his process. And it is bizarre for us on the outside to be like, okay, well, you were under control in this start. Why didn't you do that last time? Like, why didn't you just think about this before? Why didn't you think about this every start? And I think it's just an important reminder that pitchers, ball players, and really any person is constantly adjusting to new information about how they feel and how their body feels. And so I would imagine that in his, let's be real, his first real postseason start, I mean, he had a weird one a couple of years ago with the White Sox where he was hurt and gets Astros, whatever, in Yankee Stadium, pinstripes, all that stuff, right? How he was going to react to that, he didn't really know, and he reacted poorly. And so he had to make that adjustment. And we saw him make that adjustment in this game. He was sensational. It was really cool to watch. And 9 punch outs and no walks. Like, that's why you give this guy 162.
Yeah. Everything you said about Carlos was accurate. I'll just say bigger picture, and Carlos was a big part of that. But, I mean, this is exactly what I kind of mentioned in the preview. The Yankees will walk and the Guardians won't. Now, did I expect the Guardians to swing and miss this many times against anybody? No, but that's, 14 strikeouts and one walk, no matter who you're facing, is usually not going to get the job done on offense. And they are going to have a more consistent, approach against Gerrit Cole. And that's not an easy thing to do, as it will be Gerrit Cole against Tanner Bibee in game two. Like I said, I do believe in Bibee. I think Bibee can give them a strong outing. I think it's really going to be for Cleveland, as they showed against Carlos. They can pop a homer. It's in there, right? It's just a matter of when that happens. And so if they can do that at a more timely with someone on base, if Cole is a little wild at times, we'll see. But obviously Cole's been so awesome recently, and we'll see how that matchup kind of shakes out.
Jose Ramirez also is freaking locked in right now.
I know I was gonna say,
he didn't deliver last night, but in those two last at-bats against Rodon, he smoked balls that are probably hits if the wind's not blowing in, and was, I think it was a 9-pitch at-bat in the final batter that Rodon faced. He just looks locked in. And if the weather is not as formidable as it was in game one, very curious to see what he could do against Cole in game two.
Well said. That last at bat where Carlos was basically emptying the tank, I think his hardest pitches of the night were all in that last at bat against Ramirez, and threw him everything, and he lined out to center. But all right, that's it. We will see if Cleveland can respond. They have many times before, but they'll have to do it against Gerrit Cole, which is not a particularly fun assignment. That will be tonight. You will be there. And we will talk about it later this week. We're going to take a quick break. And when we return, we are going to hit a couple more topics before we say goodbye.
All right, let's talk about Taylor Swift. Not just so people click on our podcast, but because it is funny. Look, it came out yesterday that Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce were going to be at this game. Go ahead.
I wanted to ask you about that because the first tweet I saw was from Brian Hoke.
Same.
So I don't know if Boone had mentioned in the presser. I was curious how you received and how that information spread as someone who was at the ballpark early.
It really was the tweet from Hoke. Like, I didn't see it any other way. Then MLB tweeted it out. And then it's just kind of the whisper, like everyone's just kind of talking and bantering about it before the game. So why, right? Why are they here? Why is the most famous pop star, music star in the world here? Well, Travis Kelce grew up in Cleveland and is a Guards fan, allegedly. Jordan Schusterman, my dear co-host, once wrote a full article at Yahoo Sports about whether Travis Kelce was a Guards fan or a Yankees fan, going through some of his old tweets, including one where he referred to them as, quote, my Yankees. Well, his Yankees faced off against his Guardians in this one, and so they came out. Here's the experience of them being there, okay, right? Like, you're in the press box. Really, I'm in the press box. And, like, you know Swift is there. And obviously, like, you don't want to overreact to that. I like Taylor Swift. I would not classify myself as a Swiftie. I've not seen her live. Her songs are good. I don't have any other thoughts really about her. Should I try to find out where she is and what's sweet with my binoculars, or should I watch the baseball game, right? Because on one hand, it doesn't impact the thing that I'm being paid to write about. On the other, how many opportunities do you have to be like, that's Taylor Swift at a baseball game? You know what I mean? And so the whole press box was kind of going through this back and forth of like, should we freak? Do we freak out? Do we make this a big deal? Do we write our game story?
I want to talk about the premise. So I'm glad you gave that perspective from the ballpark. But I want to bring it
up. This is why you have binoculars. Okay.
Yes, this is it. This is why. But I just want to bring it up from a broadcast perspective, because obviously Taylor Swift showing up on the broadcast has been a topic in the sport that Travis Kelce plays. However, in football, those situations, it is a more natural understanding where it's like Travis Kelce catches a touchdown. That is a very normal time to show Taylor Swift on the broadcast, right? And they show her all the time too. But like in those situations, whenever she's at the game, at a Chiefs game, there's no secret about what's going on. She's rooting for the Chiefs. And so when the Chiefs do good things, she gets excited. And when they don't, she reacts, whatever. That's all fine. In this case, there was no apparent, and by the way, speaking back to Travis, you know, he's not wearing any Cleveland things or Yankees things. There was some wonder, oh, is he going to really do this? He has thrown out first pitches in Cleveland multiple times. You know, how much is he really following baseball? This guy played, again, when I wrote that story, which I still encourage people to go back and read. It was the first story I wrote for Yahoo, hilariously, after we got hired. There's a lot of things about Travis. He played baseball, you know, in high school and college and all these things. So not officially in college, but in the summers. But the reason I bring that up is like, it was less obvious when they were going to cut to her. And so, but because we're baseball and because baseball is so desperate to kind of cash in on this, understandably, you have this clip on MLB. Taylor Swift reacts to Juan Soto's home run, which is that's what's happening. Technically, yes, because the camera cut to her after Juan Soto hit the home run. But it's not like you have any idea what any of it means to anybody in that box, and everyone's parsing like, ooh, is Travis Kelce excited about this? Is he a Yankees fan? But that's what happens when we're talking about one of the most famous couples in the world. But that's what was so funny to me about it, because it was, they were cutting to her at random intervals, like almost trying to catch her have some sort of reaction to anything. And that's which is a very different exercise than when you're watching her watch Travis Kelce play football.
The whole thing had this energy of being like, man, I really hope they like my my friends. Yeah. Like, I really hope Taylor Swift likes my sport. And yeah, also fair, because we want to grow the game. And there are people like who now watch football because Taylor Swift is around it. And that's a good thing for the sport. And like, we want a big tent here. And so if there are any human beings who tuned into the game last night because Taylor Swift was at it and was like, wow, Luke Weaver's nasty, I'm going to watch game two. Like, yes, that's great. And if there's no one who turned on the broadcast, saw Taylor Swift was featured on it three times, and then went, you know what? I've had enough.
Apparently some people are doing that in football games, which is pretty amazing. But yeah, anyway, and for us, it's just like any sort of baseball pop culture crossover is hilarious. Because to your point, it brings you back to what you said earlier. You know, what was she saying when Tim Hill crashed into Brian Rocchio? Like, that is funny on its own. And so stuff like that is really why we are talking about it on this podcast. So
now, anyway, if the question is, when do you feature Taylor Swift on a Yankees Guardians broadcaster? And I have an answer for you.
Yeah.
Tim Mayza went to high school and grew up 50 minutes, 28 Which, miles away from Reading
in Pennsylvania. Okay.
Where
right.
Taylor Swift
Tim Mayza,
is from.
Who then pitched right D2 at Millersville, whatever, yeah, one of the Pennsylvania schools.
Did not appear in this game. But if you need an excuse, you know, in the NFL game, touchdown Kelsey, cut to Taylor, strikeout Mayza, PA Pride.
Hello. Maybe it should have been Tim Mayza instead of Tim Hill bumbling around first base. You know, that's probably why, you know, during that, it's like Taylor's looking at that like someone from my part of the country
yeah.
would never make such an embarrassing mistake on defense as a pitcher. It would never
if
happen.
MLB really wanted to grow the game, they were really committed to it, they would have called Aaron Boone and they would have said, put in Mayza for Swift. But they didn't, because they don't want anybody
That's my
to watch
guy.
Baseball.
Taylor's
Taylor
like,
stands
That's
up.
I know.
He Mayza. Went to Upper Perkiomen High School in East Pennsburg.
Yeah,
you know, Pennsylvania. No,
again, yeah, PSAC legend. All right, anyway, that's enough Tim Mayza and Taylor Swift content. We'll see if... I doubt we will see them again. By the way, I mean, Trevor Kelce, we've seen at the World Series before, but I don't... I doubt we will be seeing them. We will be seeing them again during this October, but maybe I'm wrong. It was a bye week, so it worked out for Kelce.
I love the idea that they're back tonight. Oh, my God, that's so funny. T-Swizzle's like...
I'm going to take the
other.
I got
to see Cole.
Or I got to see Mayza. Or I got to see Mayza.
I got to wait till I see Mayza.
Mayza,
babe, we're going to every game till we get Mayza.
Mayza or bust. All right. The only other thing that we should mention quickly, because it is significant big baseball news, is that Clayton Kershaw is going to pitch in 2025. Is this shocking? No, considering how the end of his season has gone, which is he somehow is now healthy with all of his back and shoulder stuff, and a toe injury has completely derailed his 2024 season to the point where it doesn't seem likely that we'll be seeing him pitch at all this October, despite, as we just talked about, the Dodgers could sure use him. But it's nice. It's nice that we will have another year of Clayton Kershaw on the Dodgers. That I do take some comfort in that, because this would have been a sad way for his career to end.
I know nothing else
yeah.
but Clayton Kershaw on the Dodgers.
Yes.
Well he, said. His debut year was 2008. He debuted with the Dodgers in 2008. Jordan, we were in the seventh grade.
Yeah. We were finishing up seventh grade. This is, think about this. Jake and I didn't like each other when Clayton Kershaw's career started. I mean, it's literally that simple. So
look at what Clayton Kershaw did. Now we like each other.
Thank you, Clayton. We couldn't have done it without you. All right, that's it. Thank you all for listening. Thank you, producer Andrew Hartz, for producing this early on this Tuesday morning. You can email us at baseballbarbercast@gmail.com, and we'll be back later this week on an undetermined date. But we'll be back soon. Thank you all for listening. We'll talk to you soon.